Hi, I'm Mark Hummel. I hope you're enjoying the Harmonica Party and the other content that we post on our channel. Now you can become part of the show for the price of a cheap cup of coffee. For $3 a month, you can help bring the blues and the stories to you. Check out our Patreon page and join us for exclusive content, early releases of episodes, and some rewards specifically for our Patreon friends. Thanks for helping us keep the blues alive. All right, welcome everyone to Mark Hummel's Harmonica Party. And I'm sitting here with Elvin Bishop and Bob Welsh. And they play together in the Big Fun Trio. And we're just going to talk to Elvin and Bob, and we're going to concentrate on Elvin's past, his future, songwriting, guitar playing, all the things that go into making music for Elvin Bishop. And you were born in California, is that right?
Yeah, my dad was in the Army, and he was stationed in Glendale, or down, you know, by L.A. someplace. And it was 1942, it was during World War II, and we were there for a year or two. Then we moved back to his homeland, which is Iowa.
Oh, okay. So, and then, Oklahoma came later.
I moved to Oklahoma when I was about 10, I think.
From what I recall, you got into music as a teenager, like through the radio?
Yeah, I listened to stations like WLAC in Nashville.
Right.
Like a whole lot of, that's how a whole lot of white guys got exposed to blues.
Right.
In the 50s. And I lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is on the prairie. It's basically flat.
Right.
And all the local stations would close down at midnight, and then stations from far away would come in.
Uh-huh.
We could hear WLAC.
And yeah.
They were playing the good stuff at that time.
Yeah.
Middle 50s.
So what was it that caught your ear about blues back then?
I don't know. I remember the first blues tune that really got me going was, I listened to, I'm sitting there. It's after midnight. I'm not supposed to be up anymore. And I had one of these big old radios, and the tubes are glowing orange in the dark, you know, and Jimmy Reed comes on with that sharp cutting harp on the Honest I Do.
Right.
I said, oh, God damn, that's it. That's it. I'm gone.
And you ended up cutting that later, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who were your favorites back then on the radio besides Jimmy Reed?
I like Lightnin' Slim. I like Lightnin' Hopkins, John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters,
mm-hmm.
Wolf, guys like that.
Yeah. And then how do you end up on the guitar?
Well, I used to go to these dances when I was in junior high school. I noticed all the girls were gathered around the guitar players. You know? I went out and got a guitar at the pawn shop, but I didn't know what I was doing. The strings are about that far off the fingerboard. I worked on it, and there's nobody in the neighborhood play guitar, not nobody in my family. And I was trying to learn some chords out of a book, and I was trying to mash those strings down. I said, damn, this guitar is hard. I get the hell with this. And then I go back to the next dance, and there those girls were again. And I said, better get back on it.
It was female like, persuasion.
I think that's what does it for most guys.
I think you're right. Yeah, true. So, and then you ended up getting a merit scholarship, is that right?
Yeah.
To go to, was it University of Chicago?
I didn't know. I could basically go where I wanted to, which was a blessing because my family had no money. I knew I wanted to go to Chicago because I didn't know enough to realize that that's where blues was happening, you know?
Right, she already knew that.
And so it was between University of Chicago and Northwestern. And I didn't know the difference between them. Northwestern turns out to be
Is that Evanston?
Yeah. A suburb where there's not too much hip stuff going on, you know.
Right.
And by sheer luck, I ended up at the University of Chicago, which is
right in the south
side, in an island in the middle of the south side ghetto called Hyde Park.
Right.
Within a week, I was down there with Muddy Waters and first blues band I ever saw.
That's amazing.
Muddy Waters, Otis Spann, Willie Big Eye Smith, Pat Hare, James Cotton.
That's a pretty good start.
These blues bands are pretty good. Wow, that's great.
Yeah. And like, is it true that a week after you moved there that you you met Butterfield? Like pretty much like soon as
I think
you...
I met him the first or second day I was there.
Wow.
Just luck. He lived in Hyde Park.
Right, I knew that.
Yeah, he'd gone to Hyde Park High School. At the time, he didn't play any harmonica to speak of. He played guitar.
That's what I heard, yeah.
And it took him about 6 months.
On the guitar, you mean, or the harp? On the harp, right.
Yeah, when he started playing harp, it's just a natural genius.
Went right through it, yeah.
Man.
I love the story I heard you tell about that when you first got to Chicago, you were living like in an abandoned mansion or something on the south side?
No, it wasn't a mansion.
What was it?
Well, they pulled the same thing they did in San Francisco. They called it urban renewal.
Right.
And basically, what it was trying to get rid of the black people, you know, in certain areas. So they had all these empty houses, but kind of old and beat up. And they messed up and left the electricity and the running water on.
So amazing.
Yeah.
That is so amazing.
So I just go find a good one and squat there for a couple of months.
That is so wild. And you're going to school at the same time?
I think this was after I got kicked out of school.
Oh, you got kicked out of school?
Not exactly kicked out, yeah. But I just kind of...
Now, what was your major back then?
I started out in physics because the scholarship was sponsored by this steel company, and that sounded good to them. And I got there, and I got all the way up to calculus, and then I said, I can't have this, you know. The fortunate thing was University of Chicago is the type of school where all you had to do is pass the test. You didn't have to go to class if you could pass the test.
Really?
Yeah. So I'd just go get lost in the ghetto and hang out at Smokey's house.
So you met, is Smokey one of the first cats you met on the south side?
Yeah, pretty close to some of the first, yeah.
You played a little bit with Hound Dog Taylor.
Yeah.
And I know
you did your homework, Mark.
Well, no, I've known this stuff about you for a long time. You know, one of the things I was going to say that, you know, when you came by and sat in the other day, that I just realized when I watched you play, and the fact that you, like, learned to play with your fingers all of a sudden, that just blows my mind. You've only been doing that, like, 5 years or something?
Yeah. I felt more natural. I got tired of all the licks I had with the pick, you know.
Right. So you're kind of changing things up, yeah.
It's more of a direct feeling.
Yeah. But that watching you play, as long as, I mean, I've been watching you play, I don't even know if you know this, but I mean, I've been seeing you play since about 1975.
Wow.
Something like that. I remember the first time I saw you were sitting there with Grayson Street.
Yeah.
At the Keystone. And the thing about you is, and I notice this about a lot of players, there's the people that are really blues players, it's like there's just this direct line to blues that they play out of their guitar. And you got that. I think Bob has that. Rusty's got that. You guys have this thing, and it's just like a direct line into the music when you play.
I don't know exactly what that means, but it sounds good.
Well, I mean, it's just that's you are just a blues guitar player. I mean, whether you're playing rock,
that's basically what I'm interested in.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the other thing is just, to me, the fact that you learn from all these cats in the South Side, like Hound Dog and Smokey, and I know Sammy Lawhorn showed you stuff early on.
Right. Otis Rush was real nice. He showed me a lot of stuff. Yeah. He's left-handed, but it didn't make much difference.
Right.
It was more the feeling of, wow, I'm sitting here with Otis Rush.
That's
this is
so
cool.
Mind-boggling. Yeah.
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 And you knew Magic Sam a little bit, too?
Yeah. Yeah, he was a real nice guy. I got to know him more so when we both got to the West Coast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because he lived out here for a little bit.
He used to play
like 3 months or something
in Berkeley a lot.
Right.
The New Orleans house. You ever remember that place? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Mandrakes, I think, too.
Yeah.
Right. You know, speaking of Sammy Longhorn, there's a great story where Elvin showed up to a Junior Wells gig, and Junior Wells had no idea that Elvin was showing up to play.
Nobody was getting rich in those days. You were making 10, 12 bucks a night, you know?
Right.
And if somebody offered you 15, you're going.
Right,
you
know? Right, right.
It's like...
that was good money back then.
Yeah, and Sammy got an offer to play with Muddy on a tour down south.
You know? Oh, okay.
But he was scared to tell Junior, so he stayed in that hotel, Lil Morocco, the Blue Flame Club, you know?
Yeah.
And we'd sit up there, and he taught me all of Junior's tunes as well as he could.
Yeah.
So he said, go down there Tuesday and play with Junior. I went down there. I said, hello, Junior. He said, hello, who are you? I said, my name's Bishop. Sammy sent me here to take his place for the next 2 weeks. Junior says, he did. He took me in the back and tried me out on some of the tunes, and he saw that I halfway knew him. And
right.
Anyway, it's too late. He couldn't do no better anyway. Right. Right then. So,
too late, baby.
I'll tell you what Junior taught me. He said, now, if you want your time to be really good, don't pat your foot like this with your toe.
Oh, interesting.
Pat it with your heel.
With the heel, huh? Yeah.
Bob knows how to play Chicago blues a lot better than I do. Well, he really plays it like
I think you both. I think you both play it.
I don't know. I've never been able to really get some of those parts exactly like the guys played it. You know, I just kind of.
And I know
feeling.
Tucker's another guy you were around quite a bit. I remember.
I love Tucker.
I remember seeing you with Tucker back. You guys were Tucker was doing a KPFA radio show. This was in about 1976, and you just happened to show up for it.
Yeah.
It was with Gary Silva and Derek Walker and a bunch of guys. I don't know if you remember that when KPFA was upstairs.
Yeah.
In Berkeley.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was obviously you guys were real tight.
Tuck's was a great musician.
He was.
That was a sad thing when he passed away. I had dreams about him for a couple of years after he passed away, yeah. I dreamed I went to his house, knocked on the door, and he came. He had his pajamas on. I said, oh, thank God, you didn't die after all. Then I woke up.
I remember when he lived right down the road here, man. But, I think Musselwhite was telling me that he used to stay at Tucker's house when he first came out here, too.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, it could be. Sure.
How did you go? Now you joined Butterfield in, was it 63 or 64, something like that?
Yeah.
So when you guys first came out here, I mean, it seems to me that Butterfield Blues Band was really kind of this earth-shaking thing on the West Coast, because basically all the hippie bands were here, and then you guys made it to the Avalon and then the Fillmore. Mm-hmm. And it was like the musicians out here weren't really prepared for what you guys could do, in the sense of that you were much more advanced musically.
Blues musicians were expected to have a certain amount of technique and sophistication in their playing. And I think the rock music out here came sort of more directly from folk music.
True.
Where you just strum.
That's a good point.
Instead of good playing point. That.
Yeah. But, I mean, it seems like, you know, you guys really started something, I think, you know, by coming out here and playing for Bill Graham. And then eventually you guys, I assume, toured all over the states a certain amount. I don't know how much.
Well, when the Butterfield Band first went on the road, they didn't know what the hell to do with us, because there wasn't an established circuit for this type of thing, you know.
Right.
One got established in the next couple of years, you know. But they'd try us in a jazz club one time, and maybe a university next week, and then a club in the ghetto next week. And, They didn't know what the hell to do with this.
And did you have a booking agency? Is that how you get engaged? Or
yeah. They just called him up? He had a manager, this guy, Albert Grossman.
Oh, Grossman.
Yeah. And he kind of, I don't have something to do with the booking. I didn't even know what a booking agent was at the time.
Right.
But we half the time, we'd have to stay in a black part of town because...
Because you had black guys in there.
Yeah, they would not... This was before civil rights.
Right. You guys started as a quartet, and I have to say, and I know Musselwhite kind of said the same thing. He goes, you know, I kind of like the quartet the best.
He does Musselwhite almost as good as you, Bob.
And it seemed like when you guys were doing the quartet, it was much more of a kind of classic blues band kind of thing that you were doing.
Yeah.
Like Walter covers and...
I don't think it maybe would have crossed over quite so strong if Bloomfield hadn't been in it. Though.
Right.
He had that kind of... it's sort of the same reason Joe Bonamassa is...
Right, it's like the extra push. Yeah.
But...
flashy.
Which ain't my cup of tea, but...
Right. Well, that's why I dug your playing back then, because it was like... I heard that record... it's actually on here, that Rare Gems record.
Yeah.
And you playing with Billy Boy and Cotton.
Right.
And I heard you playing on that, and I went, wow, he really knows that stuff. It really impressed
me. I always thought that the more, where Butterfield really had the, his strongest thing was when he stayed in the blues format.
Right.
And the more he spread out from that, he kind of... lost strength.
Yeah, no, I can dig that. Yeah, and I mean the one thing I think about Butterfield is just he had a real strength for covering a lot of different ground in the band. That you know he played. You know he would do R&B. He would do hardcore blues. He would do you know New Orleans R&B. You know you might do a Percy Mayfield song or something like that. And that he featured guys. And that was another thing I thought was really cool.
Well, you know. That a lot of that comes from playing five or six shows a night.
Right.
It's the same reason that that the level of musicianship was high in Chicago because I don't care if you're Muddy Waters or who you are, when it gets 2 o'clock in the morning, stays open until 4 or 5. You're glad to see anybody come and help you. It's like an employment agency. You go and sit in with somebody, you want to make a good showing. So you learn their tunes.
Right.
So you end up learning a lot of different tunes.
Right.
And
that's great for musicians, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I left off talking about the Butterfield Band. By the time you left in 69, he had added horns and had gone more in a, what would you say, like R&B direction maybe? Or how would you
Yeah, a little bit more. It was fun playing with the horns, though, that's for sure.
I wish there was more video footage of that lineup, but there's some at the Monterey, you know.
That's right. Festival.
You can hear it.
Yeah.
And it sounds great because they're doing like a drifting and drifting.
Right, yeah. That's great, actually.
Mark Nathlin arranged that. He made a nice arrangement.
Yeah, that was a good arrangement.
David Sanborn used to kill on a lot of stuff, you know.
So he was in the band when you were in there?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. And he stayed in, I think, right to the end, didn't he?
I don't know.
Yeah, he's on the very last album, so he was in there till the end. So what was it, where did you decide you wanted to start your own band?
Late 60s, I guess. It's a normal thing, you know.
Yeah.
You get to do one or two songs that you are really close to your heart every night, and then after a while, the feeling starts creeping in on you. What if I got to do all songs that I wanted, you know? Mm-hmm. I hope you don't get feeling like that too soon, Bob.
Well, yeah. No, you know, things are different now, and yeah. I think I remember you telling me that you know, your first record deal that you kind of had a little help maybe from some of the members of Jefferson Airplane. I think you might have been in the same place.
Indirectly, yeah. They had a law. It was against the law to be in a place where marijuana was being consumed. And I was at a party at the Jefferson Airplane's house. I was drinking. I wasn't, you know, smoking weed. But they put me in jail anyway.
Wow.
And their lawyer came and got me out. He said, have you got a record contract? I said, no. He said, you want one?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty easy.
Bill Graham, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And that was with Capricorn Records?
Or no, that was with Bill Graham's label.
Bill Graham's label. Fillmore, oh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you had Applejack in there. I think, wasn't Steve Miller on the record?
I don't think Steve Miller was.
Was he not on that record?
He was on the next one, maybe. Right. The second one or the third one.
Right. And then Jo Baker, she came into the band, what, about three albums in or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you were writing at that point. I would think that it would help to be writing when you have somebody else that's singing. Probably makes it a little bit easier to write. I don't know. What do you think? You think that plays a part in it?
That's probably true. If you're writing for yourself, then you got to deal with your own limitations, you know, and you have to write within those.
Right.
You're writing like Jo Baker had a really nice range and mm-hmm. soulful quality.
Right.
So,
well, when you wrote Fooled Around, you kind of had that little chord structure.
I tried to talk two or three people into singing it.
Hmm.
Jo Baker.
She didn't want to do it.
Didn't quite butter the biscuit for her. And then,
hmm.
Ricky Kellogg.
Oh, yeah.
Really?
He had a great voice, but
yeah,
he didn't, you know, have a feeling for the tune.
Didn't relate to it, yeah. And that's a great song. I mean, that's really, you got, that's great songwriting. You were
right. Goes being nice.
No, I'm serious. I was thinking about it, and I was thinking, you know, just your construction of the way you put together songs, you obviously put a lot of care and you must have patience to be able to write like that. Because, I mean, I know from myself, a lot of times I kind of rush job songs. They'll come out and I won't really mess with them all that much afterwards. And you seem to put a lot of care into how you...
try to get them as good as possible, you know?
Yeah.
I've always been lucky because I've had really great musicians in my band, you know?
Mm-hmm.
My MO would be to write as much of the tune as I could, then bring it to a rehearsal and not give anybody any hints, just see what people could come up with, you know? And because I figure you're limiting yourself if you don't get all the help you can with something, you know?
Which is why you got this guy.
No, he's in the band for good looks.
No, he wasn't wearing his glasses when he hired him.
Bob's a great, he's the most in-demand guy I know.
He sure is.
He does
absolutely.
Muscle White.
Yeah. T-Birds.
T-Birds, yeah.
I'll tell you one thing is that I've never experienced, you know, being in a band where I've had a band leader such as yourself, but also, I mean that in a great way, great band leader.
He goes being,
but we're all buttering you up, Elvin.
Yeah.
But the guitar parts that Elvin comes up with, and we do these two guitar parts, and I'm really proud of because nobody really does that.
No.
I can't think of anybody, you know. And
pretty unusual.
And the stuff that Elvin comes up with, I would never think of. You know?
Yeah.
So it's like really a cool thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of been your one of your trademarks for a long time.
Yeah.
I want to say, I remember I saw you, believe it or not, I saw you on Midnight Special one time.
Uh-huh.
With Johnny V and the band.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, that was, I think, when you must have just signed the Capricorn deal. And you really had all the two guitar stuff worked out. Was part of that because of the label that you guys were on? The fact it was kind of the Allman Brothers... same label as the Allman Brothers, or not really?
No, and there wasn't really an Allman Brothers influence.
Yeah.
You know, I have to say, I've heard live recordings of him and Bloomfield together.
Right.
Where they're doing like Get Out My Life, Woman, you know.
And doing the parts together?
And, well, there's this one part, you know, where I think, you know, Bloomfield is like doing, you know, something like that. And then, like, you know, Elvin like copies him up high, like...
Oh, interesting.
It just sounds fabulous.
Man. Yeah.
So I think they were doing that. They probably influenced the Allman Brothers, these
that
two
wouldn't
guys.
Surprise me.
That would make more sense to me, you know.
Yeah. I think you guys had quite a reach in that band, the two guitar thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. They were a big influence on
me.
Dwayne Allman was great. So was Dickie.
Oh, yeah. They were both fabulous, man.
Was, yeah.
I was saying about that tune, Ramblin' Man. What a great song. You know, words and music.
Right. That's Dickie Betts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My idea, aside from Bob, the best guitar player in America today is Derek Trucks, I think.
Oh, Derek is, yeah. He's a great guitar player.
And he's very much about slide.
Yeah, but he's not Dwayne Jr.
Yeah.
He plays in that open E tuning,
mm-hmm.
but he does so much more with it.
Yeah, he's almost like a lead guitar player.
He is a lead guitar player. But I hear influences from gospel singers and saxophone players and everything in his playing.
Interesting.
Most guys who play slide just wang it straight across, you know.
Right.
But he'll search out different combinations of notes. And
So he's really got a unique thing to what he does.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of slide, Earl Hooker seems to have been a pretty huge influence on you.
He was an eye-opener to me.
Yeah.
Most people, like the Southern Rock guys, most of them, they'll put the slide on their middle finger
mm-hmm.
so they can support it on either side with these two fingers, you know.
Hmm.
And they use, you know, maybe it seems like a big, heavy slide, and they kind of right. need to do that, otherwise you lose control.
Right.
Earl Hooker put a little small
slide
on his little finger that left all these open to play the guitar just like regular.
Right.
And he figured out how to actually pick out melodies and stuff instead of just relying on what came under your hand. You know?
Right. So he tended to use it like just for embellishments, but then he could play a lead.
Yeah.
Right under that.
Yeah, you'll hear that in his songs. Yeah.
Yeah, true. Yeah. Did you know him at all?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Music-wise, he was
just
the greatest.
Phenomenal.
He was the greatest.
Yeah.
He was recognized in Chicago as the greatest guitar player.
Right.
He can go up on anybody's bandstand.
Right.
And not even ask permission. Just go like this, and the guitar player would give it up.
Yeah. Wow.
and he'd just start playing.
Yeah. I heard a story about him and BB together playing a guitar battle one time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That should have been interesting.
And didn't you also say that, you know, every time you saw Earl Hooker play, he had a different guitar kind of a thing?
Yeah. He was kind of like Hubert. He could get any old pawn shop guitar and make it sound great.
Right.
Those pawn shop guitars that had the pickups with the holes, you know.
Nationals, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's that guitar that's... that I've sort of, you've been lending me that airline guitar.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, like a, you know, I think Willie Johnson played one of those.
Did he play an airline?
I think so, yeah.
Did you get to see him at all?
No.
Willie Johnson?
I don't know anything about him.
Yeah.
He's got played on the old Wolf records.
Yeah, on the real old Wolf records. Yeah. Yeah. You saw Wolf a lot, I guess.
I saw him a couple times, not a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What about Little Walter?
I saw him a couple times. I actually played with him one time.
Did you really?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
How'd that happen?
We used to have these things called twist parties at the University of Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
At Ida B. Noyes Hall. And we'd have a Wednesday night jam session. Everybody, jazz musicians would come, blues musicians, anybody. One night, Walter showed up.
Wow.
I think he played with us with the Butterfield Band at Big John's one time.
How was he?
Nervous.
Was he?
I don't think he felt comfortable in those situations. Right. You know? He sounded great.
Yeah.
And when Elvin was a teenager, he saw like Buddy Holly and Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, like, you know, one night, and they came.
Is that a Kane's Ballroom or something?
No. They used to have these, I don't know if this was the Dick Clark one or a different one, but they'd have these bus tours where they'd have like 20 good acts, you know, and they'd come around, they'd just play in some big auditorium in every town, you know?
Right.
I remember Larry Williams was on it, Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly. I told you about Chuck Berry.
Oh yeah, Chuck Berry.
And nobody knew much about electric instruments. Right. He'd do this thing. He'd take the plug and stick it halfway in and go. He said, "I think it needs some super anarchist."
Fooled around and fell in love. That was how hot was that record? Did that go to number one?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. It was in the top 10, basically.
I think it made it to number three.
Number three.
Learned about what happened. Yeah.
So would you say that changed your world when it did that? Pretty much.
I guess it did. It booted us up into big. We were heading in a pretty good direction anyway before that happened, and we started playing a lot of big gigs.
Yeah, and be the headliner pretty much.
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And was that Terry in there at that point? Terry Hank? Fly obviously was in there.
Yeah, yeah. Terry. I think he was. According to him, he. I read some kind of thing when he did that Wednesday night thing at the Little Fox, you know?
Right.
And they give you that blast on the computer, and it's, I guess, Mindy Giles. She said he had movie star good looks, and then he did some quote about riding around in limos with us, with the Butterfield Band, you know?
You don't recall that, huh?
His face is missing on all the album covers. You know?
He was all the way to the left.
He's a great musician.
He's a great musician.
A lot of fun to play.
I love Terry. Well, like I said, the first time I saw you was Terry and Ricky's band, Grayson Street.
Grayson Street.
I remember another time I saw you at the Coffee Gallery. You came to one of Otis's gigs. And it was kind of surreal because you and Otis were both at the bar, and I heard him say, he goes, "Yeah, I just saw you on TV."
Otis, which Otis is this?
Otis Rush.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he said that to you, and I thought, that's got to be kind of weird for Elvin to hear Otis Rush doing this. But I was going to say on that solo, to me, that solo is very much of a blues solo on Fooled Around and Fell in Love.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say one thing real quick.
Yeah.
I see a lot of people cover that song. A lot of great bands and everything, but nobody ever gets the solo worth anything, you know? Mm-mm. And it's like, well, the singer might be good and they might be playing the perfect bass and piano part, but no one can ever play the guitar part, right?
So, well, it's very much your
I can play it right half the time.
No, but it's very much your thing that you're doing on that solo there. You even sneak in a Luther Tucker lick on there.
At the very end. I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, just a word out to all the bands that play Fool Around. That's how Elvin judges you. Not from anybody else, but can you play the guitar part right? And
if you can't.
Most of you can't. Sorry.
Yeah. Right.
As long as they put a few pennies in the mailbox. They play it any way they want.
That's right. You've gone from leading bands for quite some time now to basically
150 years only.
Yeah, I'm sure it feels like that. But going from that to all of a sudden trimming it down to a trio.
I always like to kind of make sure everybody's getting enough to keep themselves satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
And I had like the horns and the piano and seven or eight pieces. And I spent a lot of time standing around dishing out solos to different people.
Right.
And finally I said, man, I need to just get it down and get more direct with it, you know?
Yeah.
It's been a beneficial experience in some ways, you know, because it's tightened up my rhythm playing, and I'm trying to keep up with Bob. It's a hell of a job, I'll tell you.
Well, I really hear that you come from a country blues place when you're playing in that format. I mean, even something like What the Hell, and the way you're playing, that you're playing like in an A position, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, just something like that is very... very much that country blues kind of thing. You've been at it long enough that you've really seen the U.S. change in this dramatic way in terms of the road.
It's a fact. The romance of travel has worn off.
Yeah.
on me anyway.
Yeah. You must feel lucky about just the way your career has gone.
I am lucky. I've been in the right place at the right time an unfair number of times.
Right.
We have some gigs with Charlie coming up.
Right. That was the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is that record that you guys did.
Yeah.
Because that is such a great record. And to me, it's like, you know, of all the things you and Charlie have done over the years separately, that album together is a real masterpiece, just the way you guys were able to blend. And it sounds totally organic. It doesn't sound forced at all. And just, yeah, it's great
Bob
because Bob has played.
Put that together.
I was going to say Bob has played with both of you guys for so long. I mean, been playing with Charlie for years now. And that he knows both of your styles really well.
And Bob has such a great knowledge of old blues that Charlie and I'll sit down and we're doing the best we can, but he knows exactly what needs to be
pull
added
it together,
to make the whole thing work good.
Right.
Know?
Well, it's easy for me because I'm playing with two legends, you know, who are delivering blues in such a way that, you know, you want it to sound like. And so I just...
Gee, we're saying all the right things, aren't we, Bob?
Yeah. I'm telling you. But you and Charlie go way back. I mean, you guys are really, you know, the original Chicago Cats, you know, that came out here back in the 60s.
Yeah. Well, one year, just about half the blues musicians
in Chicago
came.
True.
Cotton and Tucker. And Magic Sam. And
right.
I don't know who all. Bloomfield let me take over his house when he moved out. It was in Mill Valley.
Oh, okay.
Then I moved to the city, and I stayed in a house with this guy, Gideon Daniels. You ever heard of him?
Weren't you talking about him?
Yeah.
He's an amazing, amazing guy. His dad was a preacher in Philadelphia, and he used to go on the road with the Mighty Clouds of Joy.
Wow.
Clara Ward and people like that, you know.
Too much, man.
We used to go eat at a place which is down by the Winterland called Brother Parker's. Uh-huh. Little hole-in-the-wall place. Great soul food, real cheap, and they had a jukebox that was just full of quartet records, you know. Old right. 50s gospel stuff.
Wow.
Did he mentor Mickey Thomas at all?
Yes. He used to. His dream was kind of a rainbow band, you know. He had Filipino guys and Japanese guys.
One time we were doing a benefit, I think, that you played for me, and my parents were there, and I told my mom that you spoke Japanese, and I introduced you to her, and she taught English in Japan.
Oh.
And you two were talking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you learned to write it, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a big undertaking.
Just like a big crossword puzzle, you know.
But you're being modest.
Well, it's a fun thing.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. And what inspired you to learn that?
I did several tours of Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were big on the Fillmore thing was a big deal to them, you know.
Right.
I'd be walking around with the Japanese musicians, and I'd ask, I was fascinated by the looks of the writing on the signs. I said, what does that say?
Mm-hmm.
And I got tired of asking them, so I bought a little book.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that you discovered the Pointer Sisters, right?
I don't remember how that happened.
Oh, okay. But they ended up singing with you.
Yeah.
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 Before they went sky high.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Elvin.
Thank you, Mark.
Appreciate it, Bob.
Amen.
All right.
Thanks, Bob.
Good job.